Hey, podcast listeners, Marco here. As Muslims all over the world get ready to celebrate Eid al-Fitr and the end of Ramadan, we want to know how you'll be celebrating Eid this year. Please share your traditions and inspirations with us, special dishes, gifts, or reflections on what this time means for you. Email us at myworld@theworld.org with a voice memo that has your message, your name, and location, and how you listen to the world. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org. We might feature you on the show. We're waiting to hear from you. And thanks very much. Violence increasing in Israel and Gaza. A mother of three kids in Gaza City knows the safety drill.
If when they hear a huge bomb, they run in the salon because it's safer than the bedrooms because of the windows.
Many say Israel's response has been disproportionate. Some Israelis counter, it's a matter of defense.
Think about someone launch rockets and missiles into Philadelphia or Washington. What's disproportional reaction might be?
I'm Marco Werman. And ever wonder where all of our plastic junk goes? Malaysia knows and has a message for the U.S.
Stop shipping garbage out to the developing countries.
Also today, the devastating impact of war on Syria's healthcare system.
We don't have a single ICU doctor in Idlib. Full stop.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Violence is escalating again in Israel and Gaza today. The militant group Hamas fired hundreds more rockets at Israel. In exchange, Israel carried out hundreds of airstrikes targeting leaders of Hamas in Gaza. According to the Israeli military, they've killed at least 14 Hamas commanders today. The Israeli military also destroyed a 14-story building that houses local news organizations.
They are targeting media offices here in Gaza, so we cannot share what's happening here around the world.
That's Mariam Ferwana, who lives in Gaza City. She's a mother of three who used to shop at the tower that came down today. Ferwana recorded the sounds of explosions she's been hearing outside her windows. In just a few moments, we'll hear a voice from Israel arguing that the Israeli airstrikes are acts of defense. First, though, Gaza City resident Mariam Ferwana. I asked her what the past 24 hours have been like for her.
All the houses around the area are trembling. And there were three children were killed inside their car. They were in the market. They are buying some fish. And they were targeted here in Gaza right now. So the situation is very, very bad. You cannot imagine. This is the worst one.
You have small children, as you said. How have they been dealing with this?
I have three children. They don't know what's happening around them. And I don't give them every details. I said to them that it's just a war between two parties here in Palestine. I don't want them to be more specific in this problem. I don't want them to grow up with this problem inside them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I am not afraid of F-16 or F-35, the new one. But I am afraid from the gun boats and the tanks. They don't know where they bombed. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Your children, were they able to sleep at all last night?
When they hear a huge bomb or something like that, they run in the salon because it's safer than their bedrooms because of the windows in the bedrooms and the glasses were on their heads. So they ran to the salon and me and my husband too. For now, I keep them busy. I give them stories to read as there is a huge pumpings I wanted to distract them. I don't want them to focus on what's happening around them. Actually, in the first days, I told them that it's a fireworks, not a rocket. But after that, I told them the truth. And we are waiting our destiny, actually. As my kids ask me, Mom, when is our turn? They mean when they will be dead.
Oh, no.
Because they are seeing everything around them is destroyed. And I try not let them see what's happening through social media or TV. But they see. And when they see the children in their ages, Mom, who killed them? Why? They are children. And will they kill me too?
I can't imagine trying to parent through a situation like this. How on earth do you answer a question like that from one of your children?
For 2 years, I tried to immigrate to any European country or any country to that is safer than here in Gaza, but all are rejected. So we accept our destiny and stay here like others.
Are you able to leave your house right now and buy necessities like food?
No, we cannot. They targeted every car walking in the street.
So how are you dealing, Mariam, with the basic necessities like food?
You know, we are in Ramadan, the holy month. We are fasting around 16 hours daily. Today is the last day of the holy month. Tomorrow is our celebration with the Eid al-Fitr. And we cannot celebrate with our families in this Eid because of this situation. And today in the morning at 9 a.m., they targeted a house, a civilian's house, without warning. They killed a pregnant woman and her two kids. And the father is in the hospital without warning.
Oh, really tragic. Is there a bomb shelter you or any of your friends can go to?
No. That's the difference between we and the people inside Israel. They have shelters. They have alerts warning them if there is rockets around them. But we don't have. We suddenly found ourselves in tomb or in the hospital. That's it.
Mariam, one last question. Do you feel Hamas is protecting you?
Maybe they are defending us, but they are not protecting us. They cannot.
Mariam Farwana in Gaza City, thank you for speaking with us. And it's a sad greeting, but I will say it anyway. Eid Mubarak to you.
You are very welcome, Marco. Thank you for your time.
I'm joined now by Yaakov Amidror. He's at his home north of Tel Aviv. Yaakov Amidror is a former Israeli national security advisor. We've seen Israel and Hamas trade blows before. Do you see this as different? And if so, how?
Yes, it's totally different. Hamas here initiated an attack on the cities of Israel after giving an ultimatum to the government of Israel to stop and to change its policy in Jerusalem, its capital. And as you understand, there is no any sovereign state who could take this ultimatum and agree. And unlike the previous operations, which were about Hamas, Gaza, and so on and so forth, here it's about the dictating Israel policy in Jerusalem and the decision of Hamas to launch rockets and missiles into cities in Israel because the Israeli government didn't accept the ultimatum. So it's a totally different situation.
The death toll in Gaza is rising quickly. Some people say the response by the IDF is disproportionate. How is Israel defending its actions?
I don't know what does it mean disproportional when they launch rockets and missiles into cities in Israel. Think about someone launch rockets and missiles into Philadelphia or Washington. What's disproportional reaction might be?
The disproportionate claim is based on the number of casualties in
that Israel,
Gaza.
Israel was clever enough to prepare its Iron Dome and to protect itself, and the Palestinians decided not to invest in protecting their civilians by investing to attack Israel. So now we have to pay the price that Israel was smart enough and cautious enough to invest a lot to defend our people, and they were cruel enough not to defend their people. And then they initiated launching rockets and missiles into civilian cities. And now we have to think about proportionality. I don't understand the logic of the question, so I don't have an answer.
Yaakov, what is Israel hoping to achieve here? Is there a specific goal or policy that Israel's aiming for?
The specific goal is very clear. Is to destroy as much as possible the military capabilities of Hamas, to kill as many of its commanders, and that after the operation, Hamas will be much weaker if we succeed in our operation. And probably we cannot be sure about it. We will have more deterrence.
Sorry, a 13-story residential building in Gaza was destroyed yesterday. How sustainable is that kind of strategy?
Where there are military facilities, rockets, missiles, and so on, this is a legitimate military target. When we know that there are civilians around, we have a special procedure to tell the civilians, be careful, we are going to bomb this place, please go out. In many cases, Hamas don't let the civilians to go out. And this is the decision of Hamas if they want that their people will be killed because they are building their headquarters and they put their military installations and weapon systems inside populated areas and do not let the population to leave their place. It is their decision and their responsibility.
This violence between the IDF and Hamas in Gaza, it feels cyclical. Every few years, it seems these conflagrations happen, the violence often escalating into hot wars. How do you propose this cycle of violence gets ended?
It's very easy. If this area will not be controlled by Hamas, but by a civilian organization that will fight for prosperity of its own people instead of fighting against civilians inside Israel, it will be ended. It's in one day. But instead of that, in free elections in 2006, the civilians of Gaza elected Hamas as their leader, and this is the result. There are consequences to the decision of the Palestinians to elect terror organization as their leader, and there are consequences to the fact that terror organization is launching rockets and missiles without any logic reason into civilian areas in Israel, and Israel should defend its civilians by destroying these capabilities as much as possible.
Former Israeli National Security Advisor Yaakov Amidror speaking with us from his home north of Tel Aviv. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
The U.S. is urging for de-escalation of the conflict in the Mideast. As far as a solution goes,
you need leaders on each side who are masters of their political houses, not prisoners of their politics. You need a sense of ownership in which Israelis and Palestinians, urged not by the international community of the United States, but urged by their own self-interests.
We'll examine the role of U.S. foreign policy in the conflict and in shaping what comes next. That's later this hour. 71 days and counting down until the Tokyo Olympics, the pressure to cancel them is continuing to go up. On Sunday, dozens of protesters gathered outside the National Olympic Stadium in Tokyo, while a few hundred athletes were inside for a test run of the event. Protester Noriko Kyogoku spoke to local media. She said the games are a celebration of nationalism and are a discriminatory and exclusionary event, which will only benefit a small percentage of people. Elsewhere in Japan's capital, one hospital put up signs in their windows with another clear message. The signs read, "Medical capacity has reached its limits. Stop the Olympics. Give us a break. The Olympics are impossible." The hospital's director, Masaya Takahashi, wrote online that he feels there is no choice but to cancel the Olympics, which could be a super spreader event. Today, that sentiment was echoed at an International Olympic Committee press conference.
We can perhaps do one last question from Yahoo.
Instead of asking a question, a protester posing as a journalist unfurled a black flag that said, "No Olympics in Tokyo 2020.
No Olympics anywhere. No Olympics anywhere. F*** the Olympics. We don't want the Olympics anywhere."
You just turn him off. That'll be used to someone else.
The IOC has since deleted the press conference from its YouTube page. According to a new survey, 60% of Japan agrees that the games should be canceled. Only 1% of the population is fully vaccinated.
I think it's really tough, you know.
Top Japanese tennis player Kei Nishikori voiced his concerns this week. He said that the Olympics are not worth dying for.
If you make a good bubble, maybe you can do it, but you know, there's some risk too. You know, what's happened if there's 100 cases in a village or can be thousands, you know.
An online petition calling for the games to be scrapped brought in more than 200,000 signatures in only 2 days. Tokyo's state of emergency was just extended until the end of May. Still, IOC Vice President John Coates said this week that he could foresee no scenario under which the Olympics would be canceled. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Last spring, member states of the World Health Assembly called for an independent review of the globe's response to COVID-19 and recommendations for the future. A panel of 13 health leaders from around the world convened. Today, their report on the pandemic is out. The top line message?
The world was not prepared for this one. It must be prepared and ready for the next.
That was Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the former president of Liberia and co-chair of the panel, speaking this morning. Sirleaf said the global systems to prevent and respond to pandemic threats are in urgent need of reform. Looking back, the WHO could have acted sooner in declaring a global health emergency, but even with that, countries clearly did not react soon enough anyway. Had that happened, this whole catastrophe could have been averted. Here's Sirleaf again.
This was partly due to a failure to learn from the past. There are reviews of previous health disasters that have gathered dust in basements of the United Nations and governments. The world had been warned that this would happen. This should never happen again.
So how exactly to prevent this? Dr. Joanne Liu is a member of the Independent Panel for Pandemic and Preparedness Response. She's a professor at McGill University in Montreal and the former director of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. Dr. Liu, your group is calling for big reforms to these global health systems that monitor disease outbreaks and prevent them. What needs to change?
We have a set of calls for immediate action to happen. Right now, we need to redistribute vaccine. We think that a high-income country would have a 1 billion vaccine to redistribute, and we wish it would do that by September 1st, or at least commit to do that. We need to finance the research and development platform and then bridge the funding gap. And then lastly, we think that we need to increase the availability in the manufacturing of vaccine through voluntary licensing and tech transfer. By doing that now, I think it's paving as well the way to be better prepared next time around.
But in terms of global leadership, I mean, your panel found that the WHO is limited in its ability to act. So why is that, and how could it be made more effective?
I think what is the call is the fact that we need a bit of a reset, another way of looking at pandemic. And we call it the Chernobyl moment of the 21st century, saying that we need to elevate the threat of pandemics at the level of nuclear weapon, where all of us agree that the consequences is so dramatic that everybody needs to pay attention, and then we need to abort those kind of events. And if we do that, then the rest, you know, will unfold naturally. It means that we will strengthen the WHO, we'll have predictable financements for the WHO, and as well, we will shield the institution from undue political pressure.
How do you raise the concept of a pandemic to kind of like the level of nuclear war? I mean, is it through messaging?
Partly, but we need to walk the talk. So it means that it needs to get the highest level of attention at political level. And therefore, it needs to be dealt at the level of head of state or prime minister. And this is why we call upon forming what we call a global health threat council.
So we heard Ellen Johnson Sirleaf a moment ago state that reports often collect dust in basements. What is the main lesson about how to prevent history from repeating the missteps when it comes to pandemic preparedness?
This is so distressing to a certain extent, because there have been more than 11 panels and commission, and we know that less than 10% of the recommendations were implemented. The reality is we are not short of recommendation. We are short of action. I doubt that any of us wants to go to another 12 months of what we went through. And if we are really tired, then we need to fix the system.
Dr. Joanne Liu is the former director of Médecins Sans Frontières and a member of the Independent Panel for Pandemic Preparedness and Response, which just released their recommendations today. Dr. Liu, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
For more than 2 weeks now in Colombia, widespread protests have gripped the nation. Anger boiling over, prompted by a proposed tax hike. At least 42 people have been killed in demonstrations across Colombia. At the heart of the movement, students and young workers. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia has more.
People of all ages have been marching and closing major roads, everywhere from big cities near the Pacific Ocean to small towns in the Andean Mountains. And young people have been on the front lines. Marcel Guarnizo is with the Colombian Association of University Students.
Sí, hay estudiantes, digamos, de secundaria. También hay estudiantes universitarios, hay jóvenes.
There are high school students, university students, and young people with no school affiliation, Guarnizo says. And almost all the people who've been killed in these protests have been in their teens or in their 20s. Numerous videos on social media have shown uniformed police officers opening fire on protesters.
Nosotros consideramos que no se puede entablar un diálogo con el gobierno colombiano.
Guarnizo says there can be no negotiation as long as the Colombian government continues to use military force against what are mostly peaceful protests. Colombian President Iván Duque has claimed organized crime groups are using demonstrations to attack police officers. Guarnizo says that's not true.
Esa es la estrategia de comunicación. Equiparar una piedra a una bala. Equiparar un vidrio roto.
That's part of the government's campaign to discredit protesters, he says. Protesters' demands include police reform, basic income for the country's 10 million poorest people, and free university tuition.
Miguel Ceballos es el comisionado de paz del gobierno Duque. Doctor Ceballos, buenos días.
Journalists from the Colombian radio station Blue Radio interviewed Miguel Ceballos, the Duque administration's peace commissioner.
Ricardo, hubo una declaración pública con toda claridad. Condena todo exceso de el ejercicio.
Ceballos says the Duque administration condemns police using excessive force, although the government has done little in response to the 42 who've been killed and the dozens who've gone missing.
Vamos a construir juntos una mesa de negociación, pero no solos.
Ceballos says the Duque administration is willing to negotiate. He says the United Nations and the Catholic Church have agreed to mediate. Some protest groups say they're willing to meet, but many of the student groups say they won't until the government demilitarizes the streets. Catalina Jimenez is a professor at the Externado University in Bogotá.
Mira, creo que ha sido muy significativo, pero no es novedoso.
Young protesters have been an important presence in Colombia's protests, Jimenez says, but they're not new. For instance, Bogotá Mayor Claudia López was a leader in the student movement before Colombia signed a new constitution 30 years ago. And student groups had led several protests in the past decade.
Creo que estamos hablando de una ciudadanía nueva.
What's different now, Jimenez says, is that the country's youngest citizens use the internet to amplify their message. They're also using social media to create check-in systems. One student will stay home and monitor the whereabouts of another student until they get home.
Entonces yo creo que ya nos dimos cada uno, estamos mostrándonos los dientes.
At this point, Jimenez says, the government and young demonstrators are at an impasse. Protest leaders are expected to respond to the government's offer to negotiate sometime this week. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Gargoyles for Adoption, that's in the second half of the show. You're with The World. Asylum seekers trying to enter the U.S. can be turned away at the border. Last April, the Trump administration cited the pandemic as a reason for refusal. It's still being used.
We are troubled that the Biden administration has chosen to keep a policy that was always a sham, was never justified by public health.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Returning to our top story today, the escalating violence in Israel and Gaza. As rocket fire and airstrikes continue, we wanted to find out how Washington fits into this and where the Biden administration currently stands on the matter. I'm joined now by Aaron David Miller, a former State Department Middle East negotiator and advisor to Republican and Democratic administrations. He's now a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So what have we heard so far from the Biden White House in the past couple of days?
Well, the big news this afternoon was that they're sending a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, Hadi Amer, a very capable and competent fellow, to Israel for discussions with the Israelis and Palestinians. I think it represents a response to building pressure on the administration that somehow they've been lax or unwilling or perhaps even unable to engage on this issue and to launch some sort of diplomatic intervention that would alter the trajectory, the arc of this conflict. I think, however, that risk aversion, not risk readiness, will likely be the order of the day. And that gives them a very narrow bandwidth.
You don't sound terribly hopeful about what a Washington envoy can do. I mean, is there even a trajectory to peace that an envoy can engage in right now?
No. Despite efforts on the part of the Israelis and Hamas in the last 5 or 6 years to negotiate a sort of long-term interim agreement, the notion that somehow Benjamin Netanyahu, fighting for his political life, and Mahmoud Abbas, who is in the 16th year of a 4-year term and who has just canceled Palestinian elections, which has fundamentally eroded his credibility, the odds that these two could negotiate even an interim agreement, let alone a conflict-ending agreement, I think are slim to none. That's the true tragedy here.
So Secretary Antony Blinken spoke with the Prime Minister Netanyahu today, and Blinken said Israel has a right to defend itself and Palestinians also need to live in security. I mean, the State Department is calling for de-escalation, but what specific influence or leverage does Washington actually have?
Well, they have plenty of leverage, assuming they were prepared to use it. The Biden administration's preoccupation with beating COVID, with restoring the economy, with ending the polarization along racial and political lines that now exist in this country is going to mean that they're going to pick their foreign policy spots very, very carefully, and they're going to husband the president's political currency in a very disciplined manner. And anything involving Israel, particularly when it comes to Israeli security, is going to mean that the administration is going to be very generous with providing Israel with support and a margin which will allow the Israelis to continue what they're doing. The notion that Hadi Amar, the envoy, would go to Jerusalem and tell the Israelis to stand down is virtually not a statement he would make in this political universe. Israel has a legitimate right to defend itself, as the Israelis claim proportionally, although sometimes that is clearly not the case. But had this conflict been focused just on Jerusalem, that might have opened up an opportunity for the administration to deliver a tougher set of messages. Once it morphed to Hamas and Israel, once the rockets started to fall, once Ben-Gurion Airport was closed and Israelis were sleeping in their shelters, the odds that any administration, Democrat or Republican, I worked for a half dozen, would deliver a message this early in the conflict to tell the Israelis to stop or stand down. And if they were to deliver such a message, Marco, it would not come from Hadi Amar. It would come from the Secretary of State or, more likely, Joe Biden. But that message is not going to be delivered.
Yeah, so what you were writing on Twitter, Aaron David Miller, that the Biden administration has lowballed and deprioritized the Israeli-Palestinian issue, is it because he's just got too much on his plate domestically?
I think it's that plus the reality. And I don't want to trivialize because people are dying and this conflict is entrenched, volatile, and truly tragic. It is simply not ready for prime time. You need leaders on each side who are masters of their political houses, not prisoners of their politics or their constituencies. You need a sense of ownership in which Israelis and Palestinians, urged not by the international community of the United States, but urged by their own self-interest, Sadat, Begin, Arafat, Rabin, King Hussein. And you need an administration that has the will and the skill to take advantage of that kind of leadership and that kind of ownership in order to produce effective mediation. All three of those factors, which are indispensable to create a sustained, credible political process leading to solution, are simply missing in action.
Aaron David Miller, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former State Department Middle East negotiator and advisor to Republican and Democratic administrations. Aaron David Miller, thank you very much.
Marco, thank you.
In the decade-long war in Syria, death, injury, and displacement have been sad and constant parts of life. There are also the less talked about consequences of war, like the near total destruction of Syria's healthcare system. The world's Shirin Jafari brings us a story of a 5-year-old Syrian boy who's paid the price.
The day Muhammad Alwais' twins were born was one of the best days of his life. Dad and his brother Iyad came to this world in the midst of Syria's war and chaos. But for the Al-Uwais family, this was a moment of joy. We went to a maternity hospital, Uwais tells me through a translator. The hospital was in an area called Kafar Taharim in Idlib province in northwestern Syria. When doctors delivered his sons, Uwais says, there was a problem. The way Uwais describes it, one of the babies, Jad, needed oxygen. But the hospital didn't have the right equipment. He wasn't allowed in the delivery room, he says, but doctors later told him that his son needed at least 1 week of extra care at the hospital. But this was no normal situation. Doctors told Uwais that the neighborhood near the hospital had been bombed in recent days and that it was not safe for him and his family to stay there. They told him, take your wife and babies and leave immediately. They went home. And as the years went on, Uwais says, it became clear that Jad could not walk. While his twin brother took steps confidently, Jad would stumble and quickly fall down. But in Syria, he couldn't get the medical help he needed.
هذا يعني حسب التشخيص هون بتركيا حسب تشخيصه انه صار معه شلل دماغي.
Weiss took Jad to see doctors in Turkey and they diagnosed him with cerebral palsy. It was caused by lack of oxygen at birth and it was preventable, they said. The healthcare system in Syria has been severely impacted by conflict. About 1 in 3 hospitals are not functioning, according to the International Rescue Committee. And 70% of the healthcare workers have fled the country. That means doctors who are still working in Syria must deal with scenarios they're not trained for.
We don't have a single ICU doctor in Idlib. Yes, we don't have a single ICU doctor. There is no ICU specialist in Idlib. Full stop.
Dr. Shajul Islam has been posting videos like this online. In this one, he's explaining what happened with a newborn who had complications.
I'm on my phone frantically. Who do I message? Who do I call? Someone needs to help me. This child's in a heart stopped like 2 times in the ICU. We're doing resuscitation. Ventilator, okay. Oh my God. How do I set the ventilator for neonate?
In this case, the baby didn't make it. The situation is especially bad in Idlib. It's the last part of Syria controlled by rebel groups. The population there has swelled to 3 million people, displaced by fighting in other parts of the country. There is only one official border crossing where humanitarian aid can get in. And hospitals come under frequent attack, even as recently as March, according to the UN.
Wow!
I meet 5-year-old Jad and his father, Muhammad Al-Ways, at the rehab center in southern Turkey. They're here to get Jad fitted for new orthotic leg braces. Jad sits on a bed, his legs dangling on the side. Specialists take measurements of his legs. They then start to cover them in plaster. The plan is to make a temporary cast, which then can be used to make the braces for Jad. But being a 5-year-old, Jad doesn't want to sit still. His dad tries to intervene.
Jad, what's your name?
At first, Jad insists he doesn't know his name. He seems frustrated because he wants to play. But soon, it will take several more sessions like this one for Jad to get fitted with braces. His father says they have been in Turkey for almost 2 years now. His wife and other kids are back in Syria. I can't work here, he tells me, because who would take care of Jad? But for Uwais, nothing is more important than seeing his son walk. He says he'll be here at the center no matter how many more sessions it takes. As the specialists wrap up their work, Jad starts telling me about his family in Syria. About his brothers, sisters, and his mom. And he says he wants to be a policeman when he grows up. For the world, Shirin Jafari, Reyhan Lee, Turkey.
Empty milk cartons, greasy takeout containers, plastic bottles and boxes of all shapes and sizes. Many of us diligently put this waste in our recycling bins, thinking we're doing the right thing. But our diligence doesn't mean that junk is getting recycled. A lot of this plastic gets sent to foreign countries, then dumped there illegally. There is a broad international effort to fix this, but as the world's Patrick Wynn reports from Southeast Asia, there's one country, an important contributor to the plastic waste stream, that's refusing to go along.
Every year, the average American produces nearly 300 pounds of plastic junk. Soda bottles, plastic forks, you name it. Lots of this stuff gets packed into shipping containers labeled recycling and sent abroad, where it gets dumped into rivers or fields, or worse yet,
all this plastic that cannot be recycled, they just burn it deliberately.
They burn it, says Hang Kia Chun with Greenpeace in Malaysia. He's talking about so-called recyclers who transport waste out of America. Malaysia, Vietnam, Indonesia, these are some of the countries where mountains of plastic trash ends up. It's often set on fire, sending cancerous black smoke into the air. People are sick of it, Hang says, literally.
No country should be used as a dumping ground. And all countries, they have to fix their own plastic waste problem themselves.
If rich nations dumping toxic trash on less powerful countries sounds criminal, it is. There's a UN-backed agreement on dangerous waste, stuff that is explosive or radioactive, and it's called the Basel Convention. But starting this year, it's been upgraded to include most plastic as hazardous waste, plastic that cannot be recycled, which unfortunately is most of what ends up in a recycling bin. This legal upgrade is a big win for the environment.
It is a major breakthrough.
David Azoulay is an attorney with the Center for International Environmental Law. He's been dreaming of a law like this for years.
It will shine the light on the actual flows of plastic waste around the world.
Almost every country has ratified this Basel Agreement. Even Syria and North Korea, they're on board. But not the number one generator of dirty plastic trash, which is the United States. And this now makes America sort of an environmental outlaw. Unrecyclable plastic trash can be put on a boat at a U.S. port, but legally speaking, Azoulay says, things get very weird after that.
As soon as it gets into the high seas, because there is nowhere for this plastic waste to be offloaded legally, it becomes illegal trade of waste because it has nowhere to go.
What actually happens is the plastic is falsely labeled as something else, like paper waste. And then it's up to some badly paid port inspectors, usually somewhere in Asia, to catch it. It often gets through. Next stop will be some rural village. And I've seen it myself. In a field in Malaysia in 2018, a heap of American plastic waste, like Parmesan cheese containers, sports drinks, and lots of water bottles. It was all being fed into a bonfire, and the smell will make you gag. Azoulay, the environmental attorney, says burning plastic produces dangerous pollutants called dioxins.
Dioxin is what Agent Orange was made of, basically, and it's one of the most potent carcinogenic substances humans have known.
No country seems more fed up with all this than Malaysia, which has received a lot of U.S. plastic junk over the years. The environmental minister there, Yeo Bi-yin, she has ordered her inspectors to scour the country's ports, and they have found more than 3,000 tons of illegal plastic. Here is her message to the U.S.
Stop shipping garbage out to the developing countries. If they ship to Malaysia, we will return it back without mercy.
Yep, she is sending it all back. Now, Malaysia is not a poor country or a rich country. It's somewhere in between. Its government has the resources to fight this problem. Other countries in Asia or Africa do not. Plastic can easily slip through their ports. So if the U.S. refuses to take care of its own waste on its own soil and keeps rejecting international law, is there any hope here?
It is depressing to see the U.S. continuing to do this, but you have to note that the rules are fairly new.
Azoulay says there is hope that the Biden administration might join the world in admitting that plastic waste is toxic waste, but only if Americans themselves apply pressure and start caring about how their waste poisons people overseas. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
North Atlantic right whales locked in an embrace. An incredible sight. You can see that photo of what appears to be a hug between these two endangered mammals in today's Top of the World, our daily newsletter. Get your own copy emailed to you each morning. Subscribe to Top of the World today by signing up at theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's theworld.org/newsletters. You'll recall 2 years ago when fire ripped through Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. And now, sounds of rebirth. On the recent anniversary of the fire, French President Emmanuel Macron praised efforts to stabilize the site for future reconstruction.
We're all impressed with what we see, with the work that has been achieved in 2 years. I think everyone today remembers where we were 2 years ago, the emotion of all Catholics, Parisians, and all the French people, in fact.
That clip from Reuters. Returning Notre Dame to its former glory is also about restoring its many works of art. A fundraising group, Friends of Notre Dame Paris, has launched a crowdfunding campaign that lets donors sponsor the restoration of individual pieces. On their website, you can toggle through a gallery of the works up for adoption. A statue of St. Peter was quickly funded, also popular, a statue of Joan of Arc. And of course, there's the iconic gargoyle, the mythical beast Lasrige, a demon, his head in his hand, sticking his tongue out as he gazes over Paris. Lasrige isn't the only so-called guardian demon at Notre Dame. Plenty of gargoyle monsters anyone could love still available. President Biden faces a big test at the U.S.-Mexico border, whether to keep a Trump-era scheme that lets U.S. officials turn away most migrants and asylum seekers because of the pandemic. When they're turned away, they're stuck in Mexico and often face dangerous conditions. One man from Honduras recently put it this way.
Ellos son los dueños de la frontera.
They are the bosses at the border, he says. They, meaning Mexican drug cartels. The World's Monica Campbell has been following the story and reports on efforts to get some families to safety. One note, for their security, we're only including the first names of some of the people Monica spoke with.
Day by day, Felicia Rangel Sampanaro is seeing more migrants arrive to Reynosa, a city in Mexico just across from South Texas.
Once you cross the bridge into Reynosa, and if you look immediately over to your left, you're going to see hundreds of people.
A video she shared shows people in tents in a main square or crammed in a gazebo.
Full-on families, babies, moms, dads, crammed from foot to head, foot to head.
Rangel Sampanaro runs a nonprofit called the Sidewalk School for Children Asylum Seekers. Last year, the Trump administration largely blocked migrants from entering the U.S. using a CDC order called Title 42. President Biden is keeping it in place. Since last April, U.S. officials have turned back migrants more than 700,000 times. People like Luis and his 9-year-old daughter.
Pero me procesaron super rápido, la verdad. Como una hora y media luego de...
We were turned back so fast, he said, within an hour and a half. Back in Reynosa, they managed to get a tiny room and barely left it.
Pero nosotros, en otras palabras, pasamos encerrados porque nos da miedo, no nos salimos ni nada.
We're scared to leave the room, he said. He'd already been beaten once by cartel members. That's common. The State Department calls Reynosa one of the world's most dangerous places. Just last weekend, a cartel reportedly kidnapped 17 migrants, demanding $2,000 each, likely from relatives in the U.S. At the border, Luis thought he'd be able to request asylum, but U.S. officials didn't ask anything about why they'd left Honduras, about the violence there, the hurricanes, or why his daughter struggles to walk because of spina bifida. Under Title 42, officials don't have to ask these questions. Over a video call, I notice a pile of Ziploc bags in their room. Luis picks them up to show me.
Esto que tú ves aquí, esto es descartable, ¿no?
One bag has medicine, another catheter tubes, all donated. His daughter needs surgery, Luis says. While we talked, she rested on a mattress on the floor. Luis wishes he could have said more to the U.S. official at the border.
No sé si tú eres padre, pero el verte en una situación como esa, pues, tomas decisiones, ¿no?
He says he wanted to ask, are you a father? What would you do in my case? You need to make decisions, no? Then, this Sunday, Luis got good news. He was told, go back to the border. Immigration will let you in. You can fight for asylum from within the U.S.
Estamos más que bien. No podemos decir otra cosa que no sea gracias.
We're good now and can only say thank you, Luis says. Now, speaking from a home in Texas, he and his daughter are staying temporarily with Felicia Rangel Sampanaro, who runs the nonprofit. She met Luis in Reynosa and told a lawyer about his situation. That helped unlock the door to the U.S. Rangel Sampanaro says Luis got lucky. She worries about all the others in Reynosa who go unseen.
I think that it's awful. It's awful that you have to be lucky enough to run into two Americans, myself or Victor.
Victor Cavazos, who she works with.
What are the odds that you're going to get to run into one of us? It's a long shot.
Another long shot? Landing on an informal list compiled daily by humanitarian workers at the border. It's a list of asylum seekers that finds its way to U.S. immigration officials and can open the door for a few more. Lee Galern is an ACLU lawyer who helps distribute that list every night. He says it's no substitute for a lawsuit the ACLU has filed against the Biden administration to end Title 42 altogether.
We are troubled, to say the least, that the Biden administration has chosen to keep a Trump administration policy that was always a sham, was never justified by public health.
The Department of Homeland Security didn't grant an interview. A spokesperson did say officials are working to identify migrants who warrant a humanitarian exception to Title 42, meaning people who are particularly vulnerable. But some humanitarian workers aren't clear about who falls into that category. Tracy Horan is a Catholic nun with the Kino Border Initiative. It helps migrants in Nogales, Mexico, across from Arizona.
It's really unequal. It's a really unjust way of doing things. And it also puts the burden of deciding who gets access on NGOs, which is really not our role.
I spoke by phone with one family from Honduras who came to Sister Horan for help. It's a mom, dad, and their 12-year-old son. They'd been held for ransom by a gang in a room for hours. The mother was sexually assaulted. The father, Juan Carlos, closed his eyes while recalling what happened.
Salimos de nuestro país en primer lugar porque por la inseguridad, por el crimen organizado.
That violence is why we left Honduras, Juan Carlos said. He was a truck driver back home. He says his boss was murdered for not paying an extortion fee.
Pero antes que me la hicieran, mejor emigré.
I left my country because I didn't want to be killed next, he says. Sister Horan says she'd help them, perhaps getting them on that short list of asylum seekers that goes to immigration officials. But she worries about who is left behind.
The number is very small compared to the number of people who are seeking asylum.
Other migrants with similar stories who she'll never meet. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
With so much division around the globe, it's refreshing when people come together. The late Afrobeat drummer Tony Allen said, "I play yours, you play mine. The music never ends." Even a year after his death, you could say Tony Allen's still collaborating. His posthumous album, There Is No End, is out now with lots of collaborators. We leave you with the voice of one of them today, Nigerian novelist Ben Okri, who makes an appearance on the track Cosmosis, waxing poetic on the chaos gripping the planet these days.
Let's talk about the science of how things break, how the heart breaks, how the age founders shatters with no one listening, how the mind quakes, how we lose all that matters. Oh, the music of the bones, music of sage and white stones. Let's talk about the art of how things break.
The words of Ben Okri, the beats of Tony Allen. Now that's a collaboration. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
From PRX.